Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Truth in Broadcasting.
Well, TGIF, happy Friday, Shabbat Shalom, Juma Mubarak. Welcome. Tom Hartman here live from San Francisco, where last night we had a fascinating gig with a Clinton and an Obama superdelegate. I'll tell you about that a little later on in the program. Broadcasting live from Green 960, our affiliate here, and heading back home tonight. I'll be in New York all next week. I'll be doing the show there from Air America headquarters. But it being the first hour of our program, as always, in our first hour, Brunch with Bernie, Senator Bernie Sanders. I know he's the senator from Vermont. I consider him America's senator. He's neither a Democrat nor a Republican, an independent. His website is sanders.senate.gov. He's got a great newsletter, a lot of information over there. And Bernie, welcome.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Always great to have you, Bernie. Global warming. Now, there was a new report that was just published in Nature yesterday that was talking about the serious scientific concerns about the melting of the permafrost, that all the methane this is releasing could trigger a positive feedback cycle that could be disastrous.
Well, all of the evidence from the scientific community suggests that the problem is probably more dire than they had originally anticipated. And that's the bad news. And the other bad news, of course, is that we have an administration who lives on another planet, perhaps where there is not a global warming problem. We don't know.
Yeah, they live on Mars.
Somewhere around there. But who has for years ignored the problem. In fact, today I think they were forced to bring forth some documents which indicated some of the consequences of global warming, which they had tried not to have made public. The issue here is that we have got to move. We have got to move aggressively. And the good news is if we are smart, if we have a president who knows what we should be doing, in fact, in the process of transforming our energy system, we can create millions of good-paying jobs. Now, I know that there are some people who look at the dire consequences of transforming our energy system. They say, well, there's going to be economic dislocation. It's true. There will be. But on the other hand, there will be tremendous job opportunities. Just think for one moment. Think for one moment how many jobs we can create by creating mass transportation systems in this country that are worthy of this country. We have a rail system now way behind many other major countries around the world. In rural Vermont, rural America, people don't have access to buses. Think of what we can be doing on that. Think about the jobs that we can be creating if we stop Detroit from shutting down plants and laying off workers and start building the kind of cars that can get 50, 60, 70 miles per gallon, which they certainly know how to do. In Israel, they're going to be moving soon to electric cars all over this country. We have only begun to tap the surface there. Energy efficiency itself is the lowest hanging fruit in terms of dealing with global warming. Tremendous potential as we make our homes more energy efficient, as we build the kind of light bulbs that should be built, build homes that are energy efficient. Solar has unbelievable potential in this country. Countries like Germany are making great progress. California is doing a good job. We have legislation in that would make it a lot easier for people to install photovoltaics on their rooftops, getting major incentives. In addition to that, you have solar thermal units, which can produce as much electricity as small nuclear power plants. Southwest, great part of the world to do that. We have potential with wind. We have potential with geothermal. We have potential with biomass. Right here in the state of Vermont, we have an old landfill, Tom, an old landfill near the Canadian border where the company is tapping methane gas, providing electricity to 5,000 homes from an old landfill. Mm-hmm. We are converting cow manure into methane to make electricity. So I think the potential is extraordinary if we focus on the issue, if we develop what is called a Manhattan-style project, put money into it, we can transform our energy system, substantially cut back greenhouse gas emissions, and create jobs in the process.
Yeah, amen. Rex Tillerson, the CEO of ExxonMobil, the day before yesterday came out and said that because the this is paraphrasing, but it's pretty close to verbatim, because the science is not yet in on global warming, it's our obligation, our patriotic obligation, to continue supplying the world with carbon-based fossil fuels, particularly oil. And not with regard to the science, but, you know, obviously he's in the business. But isn't there a certain element of the buggy whip manufacturers screaming about Henry Ford going on here?
Well, these guys, ExxonMobil, which, as you remember, Tillerson's predecessor was a guy named Lee Raymond,
who
when he retired, got $400 million retirement package from ExxonMobil. And within ExxonMobil, there was actually a minority effort there of stockholders to try to get them to recognize, and I'm sure his statement was related to that, the severity of global warming. ExxonMobil has been playing a particularly bad role by providing funding for phony scientific groups to kind of cloud the issue.
Yep.
There is no debate in the scientific community. Global warming is real. According to the major scientists of this world, there's a 90% certainty that it is man-made, but it is real. And every day we learn about the deleterious impacts it's going to have on flooding, on drought, on disease, on the production of food, on national security, because countries around the world will be fighting over limited resources. And anyone who denies that is simply just denying what the entire scientific community agrees to. So it's an issue that we have got to be aggressive on. Certainly under Bush, we have not. We're making some progress in Congress. There's legislation coming up next week, and we'll begin the debate on that. So that's one of the areas that Congress will be dealing with. Another area, Tom, that's coming up probably by the end of June will be the Defense Authorization Bill. When we talk as a nation about where we are spending money, where we should not be spending, and that includes $12 billion a month in Iraq, we should also be taking a hard look, which relatively few people are, at a $515 billion defense budget. And the issue there is nobody denies that there's just an enormous amount of waste and fraud. Every day there's another story about some contract in Iraq or Afghanistan which is padded. The DOD, Department of Defense, does not have a particularly effective accounting mechanism. They don't even know where all of their money is going. We know, if you can believe it, there are over 24, according to a recent General Accountability Office study, there are over 2,400 former generals, admirals, high-ranking officials in the Pentagon who are now working for, guess where they're working?
Yeah.
They're working for the defense contractors.
Yeah.
And this is what Dwight David Eisenhower talked about in the 1950s about the military-industrial complex. So taking a hard look at defense spending and seeing how we can make sure that we have the kind of defense that we need but not waste billions and billions of dollars when we have so many unmet needs is an issue that we have got to address. And lastly, what is an ongoing issue, obviously, especially for anybody who's a car right now who knows that here in Vermont, gas is creeping up to $4 a gallon. It's higher than that, I know, in other parts of the country. And many people, especially in rural areas, are really getting killed by these very, very high prices. And we worry very much about what happens next winter when people have got to have to heat their homes. So we are continuing the effort to drive, take on the oil companies. It's a big front page story today, interestingly enough, in the Wall Street Journal about regulators tightening their grip on oil trading. And there's a lot of evidence, and I'll be part of a hearing next week on the role that financial institutions are playing in terms of speculation. To what degree is speculation itself driving up oil prices much higher than it should be? Some people are estimating it's almost perhaps half of the cost of a barrel of oil. I don't know that, but that's what some people are estimating. What we do know is a lot of these hedge funds and Goldman Sachs people and J.P. Morgan Chase people, they operate in the dark. We really don't know what's going on, and we need to know that.
Kevin Phillips writes that we – he's got a great piece, by the way, in the May issue of Harper's. I don't know if you saw it, but it was startling. I think it's off the stands now, but it's on their website, where he said that the actual – if you use the numbers, the way that we calculated unemployment and inflation just 25 years ago, that we currently have a 10% unemployment rate, we have an 11 or 12% inflation rate, and our GDP is actually negative, and we're in a serious recession.
No, that's right. I mean, I think there's not a lot of debate among serious economists that the quote-unquote official statistics underrate the severity of the problem, because, as you know, people are in a high unemployment area and they've given up looking for work.
Yeah.
They're not counted as unemployed. If you're working half-time and you want to work full-time, you're not counted as partially unemployed. But I think the most significant reality that our friends in the media have forgotten about is the general collapse of the middle class and the fact that so many people are working longer hours for lower wages than they used to.
Absolutely. Senator Bernie Sanders is with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. He will be taking your calls next, 866-303-2270. Our telephone number, if you want to drop into our live chat room, it's free. Come on in, hang out. Go over to TomHartmann.com and click live chat, or AirAmerica.com on the Tom Hartmann page. I'll get you there as well. 16 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartmann, helping you win the water cooler wars. This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
The hour. It's the Tom Hartmann Radio Program's Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders, our guest for the first hour, as he always is every Friday, taking your calls. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Scott in San Diego, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good morning, gentlemen. This is the Scott in San Diego, no pretender to the title here.
Great. Great to hear from you again then, Scott.
Thank you, Tom. Bernie, I've seen you on C-SPAN, and thank you for the tireless day in, day out work it takes to do the job and actually sitting on your butt for long periods of time. I really appreciate your work.
Thanks.
Thank you. Scott McClellan just came out. He's the insider Tom predicted several years ago would come forward. Well, Tom predicted an insider would come forward. Is this the Bush administration's John Dean moment?
It's an important moment, I think. McClellan is known by millions of Americans because he was the spokesman for the Bush administration. And when a guy like that says that Bush essentially misled this country into a war, that Bush chose to hear what he wanted to hear, that he, as the press secretary, was in terms of that CIA plane situation, not given honest information, and he implicates Cheney. Yeah, I think that's very, very big stuff, because this comes from the guy who was the official spokesman from the administration. So I think that that is going to further damage the credibility of the Bush administration, and I think it will waken up perhaps some remaining Americans who still had faith that this administration had a shred of honesty.
Yeah, and then yesterday, Katie Couric came out. Tony, do we have that audio here? The sad point about it,
they'll come out now, but there's every reason to believe that if, God forbid, we go through this again, these guys will cave in exactly the same way.
Yeah. She said she was actually getting pressure from the administration not to ask hard questions, that they threatened to cut off her access.
Well, of course, and that's not a great secret. And the truth is, you know, when we talk about this disastrous war and how we got into it, it is appropriate, of course, to blame the Bush administration. But the collapse of the media is equally significant.
Yep.
And unless we have a new media, which is more widely dispersed, including a strong presence on talk radio, a strong presence on the Internet, the fight to get alternative points of view on television, that will happen again tomorrow. You know, it's the same old story. They'll talk about we made a mistake, and then tomorrow comes, they do the same thing.
Yeah.
So corporate media is an issue we've got to continue focusing on.
Amen. Don in Iowa. Hey, Don, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yes, I used to be a soldier, and I just got out. And this GI Bill, I'm really curious about it because I heard that Bush could still veto it if it gets 10 senators to flip on it, and I'm just curious about that.
Good. All right, Don, it's funny. I just came from a ceremony with the Vermont National Guard where I talked to some of the soldiers about it. First of all, in my view, this is legislation introduced by Senator Webb. It's very bipartisan.
And Hagel.
Chuck Hagel has played a very good role in it. John Warner of Virginia, former chairman of the Armed Forces Committee, former World War II veteran, played a very strong role in it. Enormous support for it in the Congress, bipartisan. What this bill does is say to the soldiers who fought from 9/11 on, that we understand the sacrifice your generation made, and that we also understand that over the years, the educational benefits given to our veterans have diminished significantly as the cost of a college education has risen precipitously. And what we want to do is return to the period of World War II, where the United States government passed one of the most important pieces of legislation that has ever passed. And it said to the soldiers who fought in World War II, thank you so much for what you have done in fighting Hitlerism and Japanese imperialism. Thank you for winning that war. Now when you come home, we're going to give you the opportunity to get a college degree. We're going to pay for your tuition. We're going to give you a stipend to take care of your families. We're going to do that. And not only was that the right thing to do for those soldiers who certainly deserved it, it was the right thing to do for our country, because you had an untold number of people who otherwise never would have gone to college, who got a college degree, who started a business, who became a doctor, who became a very valuable member of their community. And I would argue that was certainly one of the reasons why between 1945 and 73, the United States had the most significant economic spurt and growth of the middle class that we have had in modern history. So I think we need to do it for the men and women who have put their lives on the line, and second of all, for our country. We need a better educated workforce, and this is a very good piece of legislation. Will Bush veto it? We will see. There's a lot of pressure on him not to do it. I think we may have the votes to override the veto, but as of today, to the best of my knowledge, he is still opposed to that legislation.
Dan in Missouri, we have just a half a minute here before this break. Quick one?
Yeah, hi. I have two quick questions. My first quick question is why can't we get a car like the Aygo sold in Europe, regular gas engine, getting 40 in the city and 55 on the highway? We can't buy those cars here. It's AYGO. Second question, isn't all this global warming stuff just about a carbon tax that you guys want to put on gas and electricity and everything else?
Bernie, you want to pick those up on the other side of the break?
Yeah, why don't we pick them up when we come back?
Okay, great. We'll pick those up on the other side of the break. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Brunch with Bernie, our hour with Senator Bernie Sanders. His website, sanders.senate.gov. Check it out. Ours, of course, tomhartman.com and airamerica.com. 866-303-2270, our telephone number.
Tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. Come heed me, good brothers. Come here, one and all. Don't brag about standing, or you'll surely fall. You're shining your light, and shine it you should. But you're so heavenly minded, you're no earthly good. No earthly good, you are no earthly good.
Maybe commentary on Scotty McClellan's
so
book.
I don't know.
Welcome back, 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our brunch with Bernie, our Senator Bernie Sanders with us. And Bernie, you want to take off
Dan
on the last question?
Dan raised a couple of points. He asked why it is that we can't buy cars that get the mileage per gallon in the United States that they get in Europe. And he's absolutely right. If you look at the CAFE standards, or the average mile per gallon the cars in Europe and China get, far, far, far higher than they are in the United States. Why that is so, I honestly don't know. I think the automobile industry decided to put all their eggs into the basket of heavy cars with the Hummer type model with low mileage per gallon. Meanwhile, they have lost a whole lot of their market share in the United States. And in fact, they are moving big time to China, laying off workers in the United States. I think that they could do a heck of a lot better, and I think the government has to work with them to make sure they're producing the kind of cars the technology allows us to produce. Mm-hmm. Tom, I rode in a retrofitted Toyota Prius that gets 150 miles per gallon.
Yeah.
Why is that car not on the market? In Israel now, what they're moving toward is electric cars, where when you pull into a gas station, you don't recharge your battery. You pop it out, and they give you another battery. You pay for that. And there are electric car companies that are beginning to start producing the good quality cars at reasonable prices on the market. I think that's the direction that we've got to go. Dan also asked about the carbon tax. Is that what we want to do? Well, we don't sit up nights saying, you know, we need a carbon tax. I happen not to support a carbon tax, but I do support the concept of cap and trade. There must be a disincentive, financial disincentive, for those companies that are producing large amounts of greenhouse gas emissions, which lead to global warming, which lead to flooding, which lead to drought, which lead to disease. We've got to stop that. So it's both a disincentive approach and an incentive approach, making it easier for people to transform our energy system away from fossil fuel and greenhouse gas emitting products to energy efficiency and sustainable energy.
Yeah, sounds like a plan. Rich in Stratford, Connecticut. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Senator, we read today that the Secretary of Defense has asked Congress for more funding by mid-July because the troops won't have pay. There's approximately $9 billion he has to shift from the services budget to pay Army and Special Operations Forces in Iraq. Now, I had thought that the pay for soldiers is part of the overall military budget. It's already been appropriated.
And thus also defined by Congress rather than the Pentagon.
Yeah. Now, if there's no money there, he either misappropriated that those funds for something else, which is a major felony. That's high crimes. That's not misdemeanors. Or he's lying to you.
Well, it's not exactly that. I mean, what we do, as I mentioned earlier, we have a huge, huge military budget. They're asking for $515 billion this coming year. That authorization has not yet been passed. That will probably be dealt with in a couple of weeks. In terms of this, a separate line of funding for the war in Iraq, I don't remember the exact amounts, probably somewhere around $200 billion for the war in Iraq, and that has not yet been passed. So I think what Gates is saying, that if Congress does not pass that appropriations, there will be problems in terms of funding the troops. My own view is that it's high time we stop funding the war in Iraq. Obviously, we're not going to leave the troops there unable to defend themselves. But the time is now to begin bringing our troops home, to end this war, which has been such a disaster, which is costing us $12 billion every single month. But the troops will get what they need as we try to bring them home. Unfortunately, I don't think that that's going to happen so long as George Bush is president.
I think people forget that when Gerry Ford was president, the war in Vietnam was ended by Congress. They cut off the funding.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, so that was the end of it. And maybe we should call it an occupation instead of a war, just a thought.
But, well, there are many people who call it that.
Yeah. Michael in Santa Fe, listening on KTRC, you're on with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yes, good day. Congress holds hearings and subpoenas people who either do not show up, or if they give their testimony, nothing ever comes of us. Nobody loses his job. Nobody gets fined. Nobody gets indicted. When did Congress lose its backbone, and is there any chance of regaining backbone so Congress has some power again?
Well, that's a good question, and I think the answer is too long and complicated to deal with in a few minutes here. But what I will say is that for 6 years, and let's not forget, for 6 years, George W. Bush had a Republican majority in the House and a Republican majority in the Senate. And as I was then a member of the House, and I was on what was called the Government Reform Committee, which presumably does oversight, and that is, it has the responsibility of seeing what's going on in government agencies and in the White House. What I can tell you is that in those 6 years, there was not one significant hearing on the war in Iraq or all the other chicanery that goes on in the Bush, that went on in the Bush administration. Nothing. And it is widely recognized by, I think, almost everybody, including some Republicans, that the Congress then served only as a rubber stamp. And you also have the Bush and Cheney people who have an ideology of what is called an imperial presidency, that the Congress really is not all that important, that they can make all of the decisions, that when Congress passes legislation and they don't like provisions in a bill, in their signing statement, so-called signing statement, they can say, well, we're not going to enforce Section 398. We really think that's not a good provision.
So there is no question that under Bush, Congress's power has been diminished. Now, since the Democrats have taken over, has there been some change? Yeah, there has been. You're having hearings that never would have been had. You had an attorney general named Gonzalez, who is no longer attorney general precisely because of those hearings, and a number of others. Has the Congress gone as far as I would like it to go to stand up to the Bush administration? The answer is no, it has not. But some progress has been made, and I hope that with a new president, Congress will once again accept the responsibilities that the Constitution gives to the Congress to represent the interests of the American people.
Okay. Fritz in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
How are you doing today, gentlemen?
Good.
Good. Listen, Mr. Sanders, during the 6 years that the Republicans had control of the Congress and the Bush administration was having them do whatever they felt like, was there any serious reduction in OSHA that would lead to the cranes falling out of the sky in New York today?
Well, I don't know the connection between OSHA and the crane accident in New York, but clearly in Bush you have an extraordinarily anti-worker administration. And if there is any legislation or any actions that are good for the American worker, those are actions that invariably Bush would oppose. And OSHA over the years has been significantly weakened, and the result is that we have a lot more on-the-job accidents than occur in other industrialized nations. A lot of our workers get killed every month. And those are deaths that in many cases are preventable. But the Bush administration has allied itself with corporate America, with large businesses, and has ignored the peril that many workers face on the job every single day. Also, in a related area, the Bush administration has packed the agency which deals with workers' issues, the National Labor Relations Board, in an anti-worker way, which makes it very hard for workers to form unions. It's now very difficult for workers to form unions, and some of us are working on legislation, which we hope a Democratic president, and we know, will support, which will make it a lot easier for workers to be able to form unions.
Great, great. Stephen in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Stephen, you're on with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Senator. How are you today? I'm a Vietnam veteran that sprayed Agent Orange.
Yep.
I was involved in a health study for 20 years from 82 to 2002, and they finalized it in 2005. The data went to a National Health Institute, and the blood sampling they still have in Brooks Air Force Base in Texas, but they're going to destroy that. Now, I was wondering if there's any way there are national health officials that are calling for the extension of that study. And one doctor even said for the study to go until the last Vietnam veteran has passed away, because it's a very critical study, but they don't want to put any funding towards it. Is there something we
thank
might
you
be able to do to save
the
that?
Answer is yes. And Stephen, thank you very much for raising that issue. What Stephen is talking about is obviously during the war in Vietnam, many soldiers were exposed to Agent Orange, which is a very toxic defoliant. And originally, I think it was Dow Chemical who manufactured the product, who said, hey, this is not a problem. You could use it. It's not going to have any health effects. Well, of course, it had disastrous health effects. I know a number of years ago I was involved in trying to make sure that those Vietnam vets who ended up with diabetes, adult onset diabetes, were covered and got compensation from the government because of their exposure to Agent Orange. And there have been a number of studies trying to determine what kind of illnesses occurred, of which there are many. So I certainly agree with Steve in that that study should be continued. Blood samples should be kept. We want to know the impact, the full health-related impact of Agent Orange.
Amen. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. Tom Hartman Program.
minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on the Tom Hartman Radio Program. And Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. His website, sanders.senate.gov, our Brunch with Bernie hour. And, Bernie, it seems to me that we had, that you were, no, we did finish that last
one. We did finish last one, yeah.
All righty, great. Julie in Santa Barbara, California, listening on KIST. Hey, Julie.
Hello.
Hey, you're on the air.
Oh, hi.
Please pick up your phone.
Good morning.
Yeah,
morning.
If you could take the phone off the speaker, please.
Hi, Senator Bernstein and Tom Hartman. How are you?
Good.
I have a question. Hillary's crazy math. I was once a Clinton supporter. I am a 50-year-old American white woman. I am so embarrassed of this campaign she is running. And my question for the senator is, Hillary's math, her math made up of Hillary world, is that her popular vote, does that incorporate Operation Chaos, where Republicans came out in hundreds of thousands to switch over from their long time Republican Party, diehard Republicans have switched over to the Democratic Party. And I mean, like, we're talking 100,000 in Ohio, 119,000 in Texas.
Okay, well, you know,
this is according to
Julie, it's hard to know. I mean, we don't know exactly who it is who's voting for whom. You know, obviously, Rush Limbaugh did generate a lot of support for Hillary. We don't know how many votes. I think the issue right now is, unless I am very mistaken, Barack Obama is going to be the Democratic candidate. That will happen sooner. It will happen later. I was very pleased to hear that Tom had a unity meeting on the West Coast the other day with a Clinton and Obama delegate who indicated that they were going to be supporting the winner.
Yeah.
And I think the winner will likely be Obama. What is most important now is not get hung up in all of this media stuff. What's most important is to figure out a strategy by which we can register substantially large numbers of new voters. We can focus on the real issues facing the American people. We can make sure that we have the largest voter turnout by far in the history of this country, and that we do not let our friends who may have been angry about this, that, and the other thing vote for John McCain, who in almost every way will continue the Bush legacy. So this is, in my view, a transformational moment in American history. The overwhelming majority of Americans understand that this country in almost every single area is moving in the wrong direction. The American people want a change. Our job is to develop as strong a grassroots movement as we can, not only to elect Obama, but to make sure that Obama moves forward in a progressive direction. And all of us have got to be involved in that. And if there is one thing that is very exciting about what we're currently seeing, is just the level of excitement that is out there. People want to change. We've got to keep pushing and take nothing for granted.
Yeah. Amen. Linda in Cleveland, Ohio, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good morning. If I had time, I would take issue with that just the previous caller. But I have something else I want to talk about today. Basically, the Bush administration is looting America for fun and profit, from privatizing the military and government to gas prices. And this gas crisis is part of the redistribution of wealth from the poor to the rich. So, and I think the answers to this crisis are in the Cheney Secret Energy Task Force. And according to them, everything is going according to plan, including using the high gas prices as extortion to drill in Anwar. Now, this oil cabal is holding America and the whole world hostage by creating a demand and then socking it to us. So what is being done by the Senate to smoke out?
Okay. Well, there are a couple of things that are being – and this is an issue I've been pushing very hard on. I know it impacts all Americans. It especially impacts cold, rural states like my state, where people spend a lot of money keeping warm in the winter and spend a lot of money in – getting to work every day because they have to travel long distances. What we're trying to, we've had one modest success so far, despite Bush's opposition. There will be a stopping of oil coming into the Strategic Petroleum Reserve as of July 1st. Some of us are working hard, again, with mounting success, it hasn't happened yet, to have the United States government take action against OPEC, which by definition is a cartel of oil-producing countries
whose function in life is to limit production and, as a result, artificially raise prices. We are looking, some of us, myself included, are looking at a windfall profits tax on the oil companies who have, since Bush has been president, enjoyed over $500 billion in profits, paying their CEOs outrageously high salaries. I think we've got to deal with them. And as I mentioned earlier, we're also dealing with this issue of speculation to see what role Wall Street and some of the financial institutions have are having in driving up oil futures. Also, long-term, of course, we have got to break our dependency on fossil fuel and foreign oil and move this country to sustainable energy and energy efficiency.
Yeah. Amen. Mark in Oakland, California, listening on Green 960. And we have 1 minute before we've got to wrap up this show.
Senator Sanders and Tom, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity. One of the things I'd like to get Senator Sanders' opinion on, and I've spoken with this from a number of staunch Republicans as well as myself, is, if you will, federalizing oil production on state or public lands and utilizing that to the good of the United States and utilizing that to promote alternative energies.
Well, what certainly has been the case for many years is we've given these guys who are operating and producing oil on federal lands huge breaks in terms of the royalties that they should be paying. And that's an area a number of us have looked, and this is federal land. The taxpayers deserve a fair share of the profits, and clearly at this point we are not getting it.
I think they're paying 12.5%, aren't they?
I don't know that offhand. But in general, we have got to be much more aggressive in dealing with the oil companies who are ripping off the people of this country in a horrendous way.
Yeah. Amen. Bernie, I've been saying that a lot today. Bernie Sanders, Senator Bernie Sanders, sanders.senate.gov is website. Bernie, as always, thanks so much for dropping by.
Good to be with you, Tom. Thank you.
Great. Bye-bye. Thank you. 57 minutes past the hour. Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. Stick around.
Tom Hartman. Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. It's Friday. We are going to get into our Anything Goes Friday. We do have a couple of guests, though, today. Dr. Ravi Batra is going to begin this hour with us. In the next hour, Tom Daschle has a new book out about the healthcare crisis. I wanted to discuss that with him. And I think that, frankly, that should be an interesting conversation. And Robert Greenwald is going to drop by and talk about some of the real McCain stuff that he's been doing, which is pretty amazing. But right now, Dr. Ravi Batra, professor of economics at Southern Methodist University, international best-selling, New York Times best-selling author of a number of books, including Greenspan's Fraud and his latest, The New Golden Age, The Coming Revolution Against Political Corruption and Economic Chaos. His website, Ravi Batra, RaviBatra.com, as you may expect. And Dr. Ravi Batra, welcome to, back to our program.
Thanks a lot, Tom. How are you?
I am fine. I'm great, but I'll get better.
Okay.
And I hope you are well as well.
Yes, I'm fine too.
Great. The main reason I wanted to ask you on is because I have been reading the Financial Times and the Economist, and I'm finding these weirdly anomalous stories. And apparently, I don't understand inflation the way I thought I did. Let me just share a couple of sentences with you from a couple of different stories, and I'd like to get your explanation of what's going on. The first is, this is from the Financial Times, it's the headline is Vietnam's inflation rate surges above 25%. This is from 3 days ago. Vietnam's annual inflation rate accelerated to 25.5% in May, the fastest since 1992, and the surge in prices up from 21% in April was driven by a 67.8% year-on-year increase in the price of grain, the staple food. Construction and housing costs were also up 22.9% last year, so that's Vietnam. Then Latin America. This is another an article the day later, again from the Financial Times. Latin America bank acts on food costs. Latin America's most important development institution yesterday launched a $500 million program to help deal with rising food prices in the region. Now, at the same time, there was a piece in the Wall Street Journal about how the U.S. inflation rate is really, we're doing very well, thank you very much, because food and energy are essentially adjusted out of it, and other nations are having high inflation rates because not so much because food is going up in price there, but because they count food in their official inflation rates differently than we do. And then to top it off, here Mike Weisbrot, writing over at the Huffington Post, he says the U.S. has accumulated a massive $8 trillion housing bubble during the decade from 96 to 2006, and only about 40% of that bubble has deflated. I mean, that's our total deficit, or our total debt, rather. I thought that inflation was when a currency is debased, is reduced in value, and so the price of everything goes up. How is it that some countries are experiencing high rates of inflation and we're not, according to the official numbers, although Kevin Phillips in the last issue of Harper's says that our actual inflation rate's over 10%. You know, what's the deal here? What's going on? How does this all work?
Well, let's see, other countries are more honest with their people, and we are not.
Is it really that simple?
Our inflation rate is lower, definitely, than many other countries. We are a much larger economy, mm-hmm. but also our inflation rate is understated. There was a change made in the way we calculate inflation, I think around 1995, mm-hmm. and they did that so that they don't have to increase Social Security payments faster than they are doing. They actually wanted to cut the increase in Social Security payment that comes with the rise in prices. So that was the main reason why they did this. There were a lot of excuses, improve efficiency, you know, how they hide their motives behind noble deeds and all that.
Yeah. And was this Congress or was this the Clinton administration?
Of course. It was... No, it was offered by the Clinton administration, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I shouldn't blame Clinton for it. It was offered mostly by Greenspan.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's the one who's mostly responsible for the current mess we find in the United States and around the world. I mean, one big reason why inflation is occurring all over the world is the big rise in the price of oil.
Mm-hmm.
But why is one reason for this rise in the price of oil is the sinking dollar. And
right.
why is the dollar sinking now? Because of all the debt we accumulated in the Greenspan era.
Mm-hmm.
See, that's the reason why the dollar is sinking now.
Both our internal debt, like our credit card and home debt, and our external debt, the national debt of the U.S. government, the $8 trillion debt, or $9 trillion, I guess it is.
Well, here I'm talking about the foreign debt, international mm-hmm. debt. That's why the foreign currency value of the U.S. dollar is sinking, and thanks to Greenspan. He did not care about U.S. trade deficit. He wanted to introduce – he had another version of free trade. Economists have one version of free trade, and Greenspan had another. He wanted free trade in goods as well as in capital. This way, companies could – the U.S. firms could move their factories abroad more easily, and that's the kind of version of free trade he had. The result was that in the 1970s, the U.S. dollar would fall sharply whenever we had a trade deficit, and that would correct the deficit by itself.
Mm-hmm.
But in the 80s and the 90s, with all the capital coming from abroad into the U.S. dollar would not fall anymore, even when we had the trade deficit. This way, the trade deficit kept rising and rising and rising.
Well, this is because we were selling our treasury bills, our debt, to foreigners rather than to ourselves.
Well, the law was changed. Until then, foreigners could not easily buy our treasury debt.
And when did that law change?
Sometimes in the 80s, and when after Greenspan became the Fed chair.
During the Reagan administration.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So that law was changed. And so Greenspan's version of free trade not only caused a fall in tariffs, but also caused a big rise in the trade deficit because the U.S. dollar would no longer fall.
Mm-hmm.
And now we are seeing a big fall in the U.S. dollar from all the past misdeeds, and the falling U.S. dollar gives an excuse to all the hedge funds and oil companies, et cetera, to raise their price of oil. They say, well, oil is priced in dollar is falling, so oil price should go up. That's mm-hmm. their rationale.
Yeah. And what do we do about it? I mean, how does a country I remember the inflation of the 70s, and I remember buying a house with a mortgage that was over 13%, over 14%, as I recall. And there was a time when I think that interest rates were hitting 17%. Now, people are hitting those with credit cards easily now and have been for some time, and they weren't back in the 70s. But broadly, I mean, you know, we seem to wring that inflation out. And my understanding was that most of the inflation of the 70s was the result of all the debt we ran up to pay for the Vietnam War, those bills coming due, essentially.
The inflation in the 70s occurred partly because of a big rise in the price of oil, but also because we printed a lot of money to finance that inflation.
Mm.
We were not importing as much abroad as we are now. So this time, inflation is checked only on the side of the CPI. But there are many other areas.
Consumer price index. Yeah.
That's right. In the goods, the consumer price index, dealing with goods. But inflation has been much stronger on the side of house prices, which are not counted in the computation of the CPI.
Right, and food and fuel. So what do we do about it?
That's a million-dollar question. We are in such a huge mess that we need to, first of all, undo everything that Greenspan did, and now Ben Bernanke has actually no choice but to follow suit. So that's a very big question.
So we need to go back and we need to change the laws that made it easier for foreigners to buy our debt. We need and bring our debt home. That seems like
it's not that simple anymore because we're addicted to foreign debt. I mean,
right.
We import. How much do we borrow every day? More than
right.
$2 billion a day.
Yeah, just like
so
we
it's
were.
Not as simple anymore. We have to change the things gradually. And make sure that the world economy simply does not collapse. It's a very delicate situation right now. As you can see, we are in a very precarious situation because while jobs are being lost, inflation is rising. This is the tough mess. This is a very difficult economic milieu.
Yeah, it very much is. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for sharing your insights with me, and I look forward to the next time we have you on the program, Dr.
Okay.
Thank you. Dr. Ravi Batra, professor of economics at Southern Methodist University, his new books, Greenspan's Fraud and the New Golden Age, RaviBatra.com is website. 17 minutes past the hour, we'll be taking your calls right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
Topic you want to cover? Quite a lot going on. Last night, by the way, I just want to give you a sense of this. Last night we had this, we called it a unity event here in San Francisco, down in Redwood City, actually, just a little south of town. And at least 300 people showed up, maybe more, and certainly more. And we had two brave, I'm sorry, I don't have my notes in front of me, so I can't say their names because I'd like to honor them, but I don't have their names right here. But two brave delegates, actual delegates who are going to be going to the convention, one on behalf of Hillary Clinton, one on behalf of Barack Obama. And Green 960 will be putting the video of the whole thing up on their website, and I believe it'll also be on the 620kpoj.com website in the next couple of days. And it was It was remarkable. I started out by asking, and I did this, they knew that I was going to do this. I mean, we talked about it beforehand with their permission. I asked the Clinton delegate to give a pitch for Barack Obama, and I asked the Obama delegate to give a pitch for Hillary Clinton. And it was remarkable. To hear these folks who are, I mean, these are both people who have been out there, I mean, traveling literally all around the country, knocking on doors and working for their candidates, just working their hearts out for their candidates. And, you know, very, very committed. And they both gave great presentations for the other candidate. And then they both gave great presentations for their own candidate. And the room, you know, in the very beginning, the Obama candidate was, or delegate was, introduced, and there was, you know, something close to hoops and hollers and lots of applause. And the Clinton delegate was introduced, and there was considerably less applause and even a couple of hisses or whatnot. And then we went into that was the very beginning. And then we went into okay, now if each of you would talk about the other's candidate, and then each of you talk about your own candidate. And at that point, I think everybody in the room got it, that we're all in this together. And we've got to make this work. And it was just, it was an extraordinary evening. And I hope that more of these kind of things can be done in living rooms and in drinking liberally groups and progressive meetups all around the country. I just, you know, it's just great stuff. 866-303-2270 is our telephone number. CJ in Durham, North Carolina. Hey, CJ, what's on your mind today?
Hi, this is about I have a question about the segment you did this week on cell phones.
Yeah, that was our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment, which is where we're not quite sure if this is crazy stuff or not, but maybe we should talk about it.
Yeah. Well, my question is, I have a simple question. If we can point a Hubble telescope at a star and say, wow, look at all the microwave radiation coming off of that thing, why can't we do something similar or the same when it comes to microwave radiation on cell phones and cell phone towers? Seem like you'd be able to have some sort of a scope or a camera or something with a filter on it that can see these microwave radiation. I think that would help to crystallize to people what kind of risk, if, you know, whatever the risk is that we're taking with these things.
Well, that technology does exist, and the problem is, I mean, certainly we can see that the radiation is there. The question is, what does that mean? And you can, with a Google search, fairly easily track this stuff down. There were two studies out of Europe in the last year that both indicated an increase in brain cancer that was associated with long-term high levels of cell phone usage. And again, one of the things I brought up in that conversation with the guy that we had on was, do we know if the new digital phones, which use dramatically less power than the old analog phones, an analog phone maintains a high level of signal strength continuously. It's always pumping it out. A digital phone just pumps it out when you're talking. And so it's at higher intensity levels. And do we know if the digital phones are significantly safer? You know, they have longer battery life. They produce less radiation, number one. And also there have been rat studies on this stuff that indicate that this stuff can be carcinogenic. And it appears that the primary agency of carcinogenesis is nothing fancy or sophisticated like knocking electrons out of valence shells of atoms, you know, the way that X-rays do. It seems that the primary vehicle is simply good old-fashioned heating, that these microwaves heat the tissue around the phone, you know, by just, you know, a degree or so over the course of a 10 or 20-minute phone call, and repeatedly heating any kind of tissue in the body is called inflammation. The body detects that as inflammation. And we know from thousands of studies and years of science that inflammation will cause cancer. One of the reasons why, for example, you know, people who have hepatitis for a long time, like hepatitis C, causes liver cancer is because it inflames the liver. One of the reasons why cervical cancer is people with the papillomavirus are at risk is because where the virus is located on the cervix, there's a local inflammatory response. And that heating, essentially, you know, increasing the blood supply and cranking up the temperature, the body trying to produce a fever, that heating is more likely to cause cells to flip into never-ending growth, which is, of course, cancer. So that's the best speculation from the best science that I've seen. I mean, I've read several of these pieces, but it's like in the United States, nobody wants to touch this stuff. All the research is being done outside the United States, and I think that's a testimonial to the power of industry in America, a sad testimonial, frankly. But this is something that really concerns me. CJ, thanks a lot for the call. I would suggest anybody concerned about it, you know, just Google around. And also, I'm very skeptical, frankly, of the devices that guy was pitching. I think, you know, just use less.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Program here on Air America Radio, 1-866-303-2270, telephone number. Charlie in Freeport, Pennsylvania, listening to WPTT. Hey, Charlie, what's on your mind?
Oh, God bless you, Tom. You're a light in the wilderness here.
Well, thank you.
I pray to God you can expand. I wanted to bring this up because the media won't touch it, and everybody brings up the fact that we know this dictator in the White House is going to bomb Iran some kind of October surprise or something. But what people don't realize is, and the media won't touch, is April 17th, 2006, New Yorker, Seymour Hersh printed in there quotes from one Pentagon official where that's when he said Bush, I believe that Iran's hardliner Ahmadinejad was, I quote, the new Hitler. And that he must do what no Democrat or Republican, if elected in the future, would have the courage to do. I am going to use nuclear weapons against Iran. And nobody wants to touch it.
Right.
I mean, this is...
Cy Hersh has been absolutely... I mean, he predicted Iraq as well. And he has a long history going all the way back to the Vietnam War of being the guy who had the story, who had the inside story, who had the...
He has the facts straight, usually.
Yeah, and there was this piece in the Asia Times this week suggesting that within the next, 2 months, I believe, that they're fully expecting a strike on the Quds Force. And the Quds Force, like, that's like 40, 50, somewhere between 50 and 70,000, as I recall, soldiers.
Oh, God. I mean, Tom, it's just, I called my congressman stuff. People, they don't know anything about it, but even Bernie before, when he was on, I can never get on to ask him, and he said, oh, this guy can't do anything. We got to, we have all kind of bills in there, and they're not going to be able to do anything or anything. He thinks he has the authorization to do anything he wants anyway.
Yeah, I know. And Bernie has been pushing legislation, not just Bernie, but I mean, there's a bunch of senators and members of the House of Representatives passing legislation that would specifically say, George Bush, you don't have this power. And I believe that that's being blocked in the Senate by the Republicans. But, this is a big issue, Charlie, and it's something that, you know, we really need to get on our radar
screen. My God, nuclear weapons!
Yeah,
you know?
Particularly with Scotty McClellan's recent revelations that this guy, Bush, can talk himself into absolutely anything. Charlie, I got to move along, but your point was well made, and we all need to be contacting our members, our elected members of Congress. Callcongress.org is the website on our homepage that has the phone numbers for all the members of Congress, or the 800 numbers that you can call. And call your member, your member of the House of Representatives and your two senators, and just tell them, you know, we want legislation. If you're not going to impeach the guy, then at least pass legislation to stop him from attacking Iran. That's pretty simple stuff. Pretty straightforward stuff. Paul in Turner's Falls, Massachusetts, listening to WHMP. Hey, Paul. Paul? No, Paul. Okay, let's go to Don in Tampa, Florida, listening on WINS. Hey, Don.
Hey, Tom, thanks very much for having me on. I appreciate it. You are a great teacher. I always learn something from every one of your shows.
Thank you.
As a matter of fact, I want to put a plug in for Ultimate Sacrifice, if I can, for every American that wants to know how this country really works, needs to not just read but study Ultimate Sacrifice. It's a great book. And I read it, and I thought that Tom needs to do something just like this on 9/11. And I was wondering, have you thought about doing a book on 9/11 just like you did on Ultimate Sacrifice?
Yeah, Lamar and I spent 17 years researching that book. and and at least $100,000 out of our own pockets, and you know, traveling around the world. I mean, I tracked down Sweatre and Mertz in France, and we sat in places down in the southern parts of Florida with Cuban exiles, who one of them actually threatened to kill me right there on the spot. You know, when I brought up some of these touchy subjects, I'm leaving that to the next generation. Because I think it's really going to take, you know, somebody doing what Lamar and I did. And it wasn't just us. I mean, you know, we were building on the research of people like, you know, our friend Tony Summers, who wrote the original book, A Conspiracy About the Assassination, and also wrote the book that outed J. Edgar Hoover and wrote the brilliant biography of Marilyn Monroe. On Bill Turner, who wrote The Fish is Red, which was the book that led us to Harry Williams, which is what broke the case open for us. A lot of people, John Davis, Mafia Kingfish. I mean, there's just some brilliant work out there. And
the kind of investigation that I think is required for 9/11.
Yeah.
Have you read all of David Ray Griffin's books, for example?
I haven't read all of them. I've read two of them, and he's been on this program several times. It's been probably a year since he was on. I am totally supportive of the research community, and it's starting to form itself the way the JFK research community did. You know, Lamar and I used to speak every year in Dallas at the annual convention of JFK researchers. Gary Shaw was a big force in that. Mary, I'm forgetting her last name. She died recently, and there's a whole memorial to her. But I mean, there's some people, really good people, doing great work, and that's what allowed us. And we think we broke through the thing and figured it out, and I think we prove it in Ultimate Sacrifice. And in fact, Gore Vidal, in his autobiography, devoted the last two chapters of his autobiography to saying, you know, because he was a good friend of the Kennedys and of Jack and Bobby, to saying, finally, somebody has figured out who killed Jack Kennedy, my good friend. And he says, you know, read Tom Hartman and Lamar Waldron's book, Ultimate Sacrifice. I was like, wow, Gore Vidal's autobiography. But in any case, with regard to 9/11, there are people out there doing that work, and God bless them. I everything I can to support them, but
Do you know if Senator Sanders would support a new investigation when Bush leaves next year with a new Congress?
He'd have to speak for himself, but I suspect that most members of Congress, you know, keep in mind, most members of Congress probably would. Keep in mind the Kennedy assassination. I mean, there was the Warren Commission, obviously, which was a cover-up, and for good reasons, actually. LBJ and Earl Warren thought they were preventing World War III. They were afraid that, they thought that Castro had done it, and they were afraid that if that came out, that would provoke World War III. Then the House of Select Committee on Assassinations met, and they actually officially concluded that it was the result of a conspiracy. That's the official conclusion of the United States Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there have been several investigations since then. But now, you know, Bill Clinton signed into law the JFK Records Act, which said that all the records relating to the Kennedy assassination have to be released. George W. Bush has refused to release them. He's sitting on over a million documents right now. To this day, sitting on over a million documents. And the same thing with the King assassination. We have a book coming out this fall about the King assassination and called Legacy of Secrets, and which is a sequel to Ultimate Sacrifice. And it's time to start breaking this stuff open. And I'm talking here about assassinations that are 40 years old. 9/11 was just, 5 years ago? 6 years ago, 7 years ago, whatever it was.
Is it going to take 40 years to get to the real truth of what happened with 9/11?
I think because of the Internet, it won't, because these communities can form and people can communicate instantaneously. I mean, back, you know, 15 years ago, we would have to call people. We'd have to make conference calls. We'd get together in various cities around the country. There was a lot of travel involved. Nowadays, I think and to share a document with somebody was a major hassle. FedEx and everything else. So
yeah.
I think it's going to happen a whole lot faster. I'd be surprised if within 5 to 10 years we don't have a pretty solid idea of what actually happened and who the real players were.
Yeah, anyone that wants to can go to Google Video and download one of the lectures from David Ray Griffin, and that's certainly a valuable resource for anybody that wants to do that. They should do that.
There's a lot of that stuff. Don, thanks a lot for the call. And 911truth.org is also a great resource, although they're not the only one. There's a bunch of people out there who are digging into this thing and trying to say, okay. And for me, frankly, the question that very few people are investigating, that I think is the biggest question, is how did Bush let this happen? I mean, whether or not there was explosives in the towers to me is not as it's an important question, but it's not as an important question as how did this administration, with all these warnings, with all these alarm bells going off, with Condi Rice knowing all this stuff, with the threat to fly airplanes into Bush's hotel when he was in Italy for the G8 meeting before 9/11, with the memo that came in August of 2001, Bin Laden determined to strike in the U.S. and the CIA sent a special guy down to Dallas to hand deliver it to George Bush, and Bush pats him on the head and says, "Okay, you've covered your butt. You can go back to Washington D.C. now." How, with all of that, did this happen? That's the question in my mind. So anyhow, we'll see where this goes. David in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, David.
Hey, how you doing?
Just great.
Everybody's been mentioning a lot about, hopefully getting Hillary as a vice president. And I think that would be a very short-term tactical good. But I think for the general election, it would be a really bad tactical blunder. And long-term, I think it would be a terrible strategic blunder. First off, in November, we're not going to be able to – I mean, Obama loses all of the credibility he has for not supporting the Iraq War by having somebody on the ticket with him who helped enable it, and even worse, basically went through the same maneuvers again with her Iran vote.
Yeah, let me say right straight up, I am not an advocate of Hillary Clinton as vice president or anybody else, but I'm not also opposed to her like you are. And I would submit to you that he won't lose all the credibility. He might lose a small amount of credibility. But look at the advantage of having somebody who can take names and kick ass on the ticket, as a vice president. That's the vice president's job, really, in a campaign, is to be the pit bull so that the president can remain above the fray and talk about the noble issues. And Hillary Clinton, she is a real fighter.
I have a lot of respect for Senator Clinton. I've been a big supporter for years, so... I'd like to see her, frankly, replacing Harry Reid.
Yeah, well, I've said that many times on this program. I would love to see Hillary Clinton as leader of the United States Senate. Thanks. Or Barbara Boxer or Russ Feingold. I mean, that's any of them. I'm so saddened that Harry Reid has not done the political theater necessary to show America what these Republicans are up to. 46 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program, where smart people get their news.
California, listening on Green 960. Hey, Danny, you were there last night?
I was there last night, Tom, and I want to say thank you to both you and Angie and Green 960 because it was a really eye-opening experience, and it was great to hear both sides. I hate to say sides, but mm-hmm. both, delegates. And,
well, it was both sides. That's fun.
Yeah, well,
both sides on our side.
Yeah, both sides on our side. But there was a couple of things. First of all, I want to give credit especially to the Clinton delegate because she really did have a hard row to hoe, and she was very brave.
Yeah,
so.
Laura, I just don't have her last name in front of me, but she was – I'm going to have to get that. She was good. They both were good.
Yeah.
She was brave. We had a real challenge getting a Clinton delegate to show up.
Yeah.
We had several people hang up
well,
on us. And,
They had a lot to face, but she did great. Anyway, two things that you guys touched on but have been kind of in the back of my mind were, it, you know, the unity thing, trying to bring people together when they're bombarded by stuff, especially through the mainstream media, when they hear negative things about their candidate, whether it's Barack or Hillary, you know, red and right or assassination or any of that stuff, and then we get bombarded with it, and people get very defensive of their own candidate and then kind of take it to heart. And I know there's been a lot of fights about it, especially like on Democratic Underground and that kind of thing. And trying to say, you know, we got to stop that. We got to get beyond that. And how do we do that when we're bombarded with that stuff? That's one thing.
Yeah,
Go ahead.
That's the challenge. And that was my last question to them was, you know, two, 3 months ago, most of the, I'm on all these listservs and I get all these emails from both camps and people involved with them. And 2, 3 months ago, most of the Hillary supporters were telling me how wonderful she was. And most of the Obama supporters were telling me how great he was. And now I'm getting a startling number of just hate-filled, vitriolic, anti-Obama emails from Clinton supporters and anti-Clinton emails from Obama supporters. Mm-hmm. And I just want to say, tell me what you're for, not what you're against. You know, why are we tearing down Democrats? And
right.
And they both spoke to that issue. And basically all either one of them could say, I think, in summary was, you know, we need to have these kind of conversations so that we can sensitize people to the damage that they're doing when they go off on these kind of screeds.
Right, right. And the only other thing I was concerned about when they were talking about possibly going to the convention, you know, that's great. They go to the convention. They have the right. But if it's a fight, we still got to work through that and unify, and it's going to be very difficult.
Yeah, I think there's a pretty broad consensus that that's not going to happen. And
I hope you're right.
And Laura, the Clinton delegate last night, mentioned that there's apparently, even if they contest, even if there's no resolution tomorrow,
right?
And from either side, whatever, for whatever reason, there's a meeting at the end of June of the committee that has power over the committee that's meeting tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's another opportunity to clean it up and resolve it then. And
mm-hmm.
and then if that doesn't work, then it goes to the convention, which I didn't know. But I everything I'm hearing, I mean, Nancy Pelosi, the headline at the top of the San Francisco Chronicle here yesterday, the paper outside my door in my hotel room, the headline was, you know, Nancy Pelosi says this is going to be over in the first week of June, or words to that effect, you know. So Harry Reid now has come out and said the same thing. I don't think that the elders of the party, as it were, the power brokers of the party, are going to let this thing go on much farther. I think that there's going to be a resolution. So Dana, thank you very much for the call, and
thank you
showing up last night. It was great. It was great. All the people who showed up. It was just a marvelous time. And Cleaver in Anacortes, Washington. Hey, Cleaver.
Tom.
Yeah, you're on the air.
It's Cleaver.
Mm-hmm.
Dan says hi at CNN laptop.
Uh-huh, great.
And anyway, I have a confession. I used to be a Republican.
Okay.
So I'm asking everybody for their forgiveness.
Domini.
Anyway, I've become a political activist.
Yeah.
And I've become a member of the Veterans for Peace organization. Have you ever heard of it?
I have, yeah.
Right. Well, they made me a member, and I'm not even a veteran. They like what I have to say and
so
all that
like
kind of stuff.
So an associate membership kind of thing?
Oh, whatever. They just they gave me a button and said, hey, here you go.
Yeah.
We like what you say, and you support us. We support you.
Yeah, that's
so
great.
The first thing I want to say is that if about 5 weeks ago or so, I was in Everett, and I was falling asleep on the highway, so I pulled in to get an espresso. I refused to go to Starbucks, by the way, because they charge for Internet.
Cleaver, we only have 1 minute before we get a wrap.
Oh, shoot.
Hour, so
okay, I'll make it quick.
Let me ask you to make it tight.
There's a fleet over in Iran. If Bush,
there's two of them,
gives the command... if Bush gives one command for one firecracker, I'm going to create a nonviolent protest, and it's going to be involving farm-raised salmon. And what's left of my minute, I'm down to 30 seconds, I'm thinking of running for senator in the state of Washington. So
Yeah. Well, that's
hear about me.
Okay. We'll keep up on you, Cleaver. Thanks a lot for the call. You know, I wonder what would happen if Bush was to do something like that, and all across the United States, people walked out into crosswalks, you know, when the light turns red, you walk out into the crosswalk, and then just laid down. Maybe I'm dreaming. But just an absolute, let's shut down the cities, shut down the country. Is it possible? 58 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Call 866-303-2270.
And welcome back. Senator Tom Daschle has a new book out. This is a very thought-provoking read. It's called Critical, What We Can Do About the Healthcare Crisis. Senator Daschle, of course, the former Senate Majority Leader, Senate Minority Leader. He's also a distinguished fellow at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, and a visiting professor at Georgetown University. Senator Daschle, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be with you.
Thank you. In your book, a good chunk of the book is devoted to the arc of history here and how often healthcare reform has been derailed in the United States from Roosevelt and Truman through, interestingly, the assassination of Kennedy and Watergate derailing it. I think a lot of people think that it all began with Hillary Clinton's efforts. In 94, but there's actually a long history to Americans wanting something like a national healthcare system.
Well, that's exactly right, Tom. And we really go all the way back to Roosevelt back in the 30s, and he just didn't think he could pull it off with all the other things he was doing, especially with Social Security. Originally, it was going to be part of the Social Security system, and obviously that just didn't work. But since that time, over the last 70 years, we have tried over and over and over again to try to move healthcare in a meaningful direction to deal with the cost, access, and quality challenges we've got, and we failed every time. We've got to learn our lessons from those failures, and I hope we have this time.
How did the JFK assassination and Watergate derail this? I think most people know Harry Truman, as I recall, in 1947 proposed a national single-payer health care system, and it was shot down by Congress, was it not?
That's right. It was. He had proposed it in his 1949 State of the Union 49. Message,
thank you.
And came very close, and he really made the case. But ironically, it was the doctors more than anybody else that the AMA that killed it, calling it socialized medicine and just scaring people about the likelihood that government was going to play a role. This, of course, was at a time when communism was on the rise, and people were very concerned about socialism or communism or anything that sounded with anything that had an ISM at the end. And in this case, it was more than what Harry could deal with. But
is the AMA still opposing any kind of efforts like this?
Well, they've become less united, less cohesive. There are many, many doctors who now support meaningful reform. There's the College of Physicians that have always been very supportive, and more the AMA is as frustrated as the rest of us with regard to the current system. The amount of paperwork, the amount of concern for malpractice, the tremendous challenges and pressures that doctors feel today have brought many of them to the realization that something's got to be done to make their lives easier and to improve the quality of our system overall.
Yeah, I was the keynote speaker about 5 years ago at the Physicians for National Healthcare annual conference, and I was amazed. I mean, here was probably 1,000 physicians in the room. I mean, this is no small organization, and they're talking about, you know, their big advocacy at the time, or the big issue, I guess, of that conference was single-payer health care. But there's a lot of activist doctors out there.
There are. There really are, and it's becoming more and more the case. And there should be. I mean, doctors are the ones that are on the front lines, and they've got as much to gain from a new system as anybody in the country.
Yeah. So you, in your book, you're proposing a system that I guess could be analogous to the Federal Reserve Board, essentially a private corporation or institution that is authorized by the federal government, brought into being by the federal government, has some federal oversights and appointments, but operates in a way that's sufficiently autonomous that it's not blowing the way of the political winds. I think what it brought to my mind was the story of LBJ bringing the chairman of the Fed, I forget who it was at the time, bringing him into the Oval Office and literally slamming him up against the wall and yelling at him that he wanted him to drop interest rates, before the election. And the guy just saying, sorry, ain't going to do it. Maybe it was Arthur Burns. I don't remember. But in any case, some sort of independence.
Well, Tom, that's exactly right. Healthcare has many challenges, but the political environment is one of the biggest. We're now in a situation where Congress, because of the intense lobbying and the extraordinary pressures Congress is under, just continue to delay decisions after decisions. And as a result of that delay and that inability to make the decision, our system continues to slide downward, get worse, and we aren't able to deal with the many, many challenges we have. Congress doesn't have the time. It doesn't have the ability, really, to stand up to those pressures on a regular basis. I ask audiences all the time, if you were to ask the Congress once a month to make a decision that you just described with that story about interest rates, how often would the Congress meet the deadline to raise interest rates? And the answer is probably none of the time. They having been there 26 years, I know those pressures. And so we need an autonomous, insulated board with experts who can make these decisions in a rational way and make the best decisions without regard to the political pressures that Congress has to feel, and with some understanding of how important it is to make them with regularity and with certainty, just as the Fed does with its monetary policy today. Yeah. And that's what I think the Fed Health Board could do.
It just to play devil's advocate, it seems, though, that with the Fed, if the Fed changes interest rates, I don't think the average person has any idea of how that's affecting their lives, although it does. They don't see an immediate consequence to that. And having an institution like Congress, which is responsive directly to the people, who every 2 years can vote the bums out of office, as the old phrase goes, isn't that a desirable thing with something like health care, where people know immediately that it's affecting their lives?
Well, I don't think it would be fair to characterize the Fed as completely taking the authority away from Congress. If the Congress wanted to pass a law, which oftentimes it does with regard to tax policy or with regard to regulatory policy on the monetary side, it has the capacity to do that. Mm-hmm. The problem is today, we never get to even the most rudimentary decisions with regard to how the framework can be made better.
Right.
And as a result, as I say, the situation, we're now ranked 35th in the world with regard to overall quality.
Yeah.
And it's going down. We were in the 20s 10 years ago.
Yeah, you're right. It's a disaster. We've done a number of programs on that, and our listeners are very aware of it. There was an innovative solution. Bernie Sanders does an hour on this show, taking calls from listeners every week, and has for 5 years now, and every Friday morning. And it's been a couple of years since we got into this topic. In any real considerable depth, but he suggested at the time, and I don't know what his current thinking is. I'm not representing this as his current thinking, but I thought it was fascinating, something that would satisfy the states' rights advocates, that is the conservatives, and that would provide the opportunity for different states to model things. He said, how about, sort of like Medicaid, where the states raise some of the money, the federal government raises some of the money, but basically you pass a law or even a constitutional amendment, although that's going to be almost impossible to do, but you pass a law saying that health care is a right. People have a right to health care. And every state is basically said, okay, here's some money and you have to raise some money. Do it however you think is best, but cover all of your citizens. You are required to do that. And if you don't do that, then you're not going to get, all kinds of other federal monies that the federal government can discretionarily give to you. And as a consequence of that, you'd have different states coming up with different solutions that might work better or not as good. And you'd have a whole bunch, you'd have this little, microcosm of experiments.
Well, I think that there's some value to that. I think that it's always important to press and encourage innovation as much as we can. I will say, though, that because our country has almost a universal need for improved quality and improved access and improved cost reduction, that I think it's so much more efficient to do it nationally rather than state by state. Mm-hmm. I think ideally, I keep admonishing everybody I talk to, please let us not make the perfect the enemy the good.
Right.
There are some things about what you just described that could be viewed as sort of in a perfect world, if you wanted to maximize sort of the innovative side of the need to look at healthcare in a different way, that might be a good way to do it. The problem is, I can't imagine how long it would take to accomplish what you just described. My guess is it would be maybe a decade, longer, 20 years.
A lot would depend on the size of the carrot and the size of the stick.
That's right.
Okay. Senator Tom Daschle, his new book, brilliant, critical, What We Can Do About the Healthcare Crisis, AmericanProgress.org, Center for American Progress's website. Senator Daschle, is there another website, by the way, you'd like to plug for the book or you mentioned?
Well, that's the best one. Website is perfect. So.
Thank you. Senator Tom Daschle, thanks so much for being with us.
Pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Well, not everything. Robert Greenwald is with us. And, boy, it's you could say anything goes with McCain, I guess, is really the extraordinary thing. BraveNewFilms.org, by the way, the website. Robert Greenwald, the filmmaker, political activist, and creator of Brave New Films. Altogether, great guy. He gave me a guided tour of your studios last time I was in L.A. It was just a very impressive operation, what you guys are doing down there. And,
well,
Robert, welcome.
Thank you, and it was great to have you here. And you have to come back to see the new things we're now in the we're in the planning stage on.
That's great. I would love to. The Real McCain and The Real McCain 2, you are getting some incredible traction with this. 1 million views in the first 4 days?
Absolutely, and we just are closing in now, so getting ready for this, 1,600,000. So within a period of time, thanks to listeners like yours all around the country who are seeing the video and sending it out, we are getting more people watching it than watch the cable news shows. It's been really very powerful, and it's completely objective. We've taken clips of McCain and then other clips showing the fact that he consistently criticizes and himself and changes his position. And the fact that he's a politician brought up before YouTube who really has not adjusted to the new reality, and fortunately the amazing folks at Brave New Films are there working away on telling this story.
Yeah, and you can see these, by the way, of course, at BraveNewFilms.org and lots of other sites out there as well. In fact, we'll embed one of them on our blog here today.
Great.
And get it, or put a link to it anyway over to Brave New Films. That's probably a better idea, so people can just get right to your website. You're working on, or you produced, a Rod Parsley video?
Yes, we partnered with our good friends at Mother Jones, where David Korn had told me several months ago, he said, you know, there's this preacher, and he's really saying horrible things, and I'd love to do a video with you guys. So it was a really good progressive collaboration. David and Mother Jones found the video of Parsley. He sent it to us. The research team went to work, found shots of McCain with Parsley. Then the editors went to work editing it. Then we sent it out again to all the people on the list of ours, which, again, if any listeners are not on, hopefully they'll want to sign up and become distributors. It's completely free. We send them the video, and then in a few days, it was on tons of blogs. Several hundred thousand people had seen it, and then it started, people started to write about it. Then the mainstream media started to pick it up, and lo and behold, 2 weeks or 2.5 weeks after we launched the video, McCain was forced to disassociate himself from Parsley because people saw with their very own eyes the horrific prejudiced comments that he was making about the Muslims and Muslim religion.
Yeah. You, Robert Greenwald, with BraveNewFilms.org, Brave New Films, your organization, you have become a political force in this country, and a substantial one. I mean, several of your movies are great. In fact, you and I met at the showing of the movie that you did in Iraq down in Portland. This is a whole new thing. I got an email from a conservative recently who was excoriating you, suggesting that Brave New Films is the new Swift Boat, and the new Swift Boat Veterans for Truth a bunch, and that, you know, quack, 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 quack. And I didn't respond, but had I replied to him, I would have said, yeah, except for one thing. The Swift Boat Veterans for Truth were not speaking truth, and I have yet to find anything that Robert Greenwald has ever done, frankly, for that matter, that you can't back up.
Well, you know, it's really interesting, and we've gone to great, great lengths because we welcome people disagreeing with us politically. We welcome people having different opinions, but we cross every T and dot every I obsessively because we, in fact, refuse to either distort or be caught in one of those silly slips, which then discredit what you're doing. And when the RNC attacked us last week, by the way, in the pages of the Wall Street Journal, they called it, this was very interesting, an inaccurate presentation. So they didn't say our facts were inaccurate, right? They said an inaccurate presentation, which is meaningless, because that doesn't mean, well, I mean, what does that mean? That the wrappings were inaccurate?
Yeah, yeah, it's amazing. You did, uncovered the war in Iraq, unconstitutional in 2004. You also did Unprecedented on the 2000 election. In fact, I'm in that, on the DVD version. That's out now in 2002. I'm wondering, and we just have a half a minute left here, Robert Greenwald, I'm wondering your thoughts about the recent HBO special.
I thought it was really wonderful. I encourage people to see it. I encourage people to see the documentary that was made by that we made years ago with Earl Katz and our good friends at Public Interest Pictures. And I think the wonderful thing about the documentaries and the shorts is they live on, but they only live on when your listeners become the distributors. We don't have MGM, we don't have Fox, but I think we have something better, which is people around the country saying, I'm going to do something, I'm going to send this short out.
Yeah, these DVDs, Unprecedented, the 2000 election, Uncovered the War in Iraq, Unconstitutional, and of course all the great stuff, the shorter and more current stuff that you're doing about McCain, about Rod Parsley, about the GI Bill of Rights, it's all, you can learn all about it over at BraveNewFilms.org. Robert Greenwald, thanks so much for the work you're doing and for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom, and your audience.
Thank you. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. I took a walk in the rain one day on the wrong side of the track. My heart would react. Now some people say that you shouldn't tempt fate, and for them I cannot disagree. But I never learned nothing from playing it safe. I see fate should not tempt me. I take my chances.
talk about working without a net. Those two delegates last night representing Clinton and Obama at this gig in San Francisco. It was spectacular. And Tony, you've got to, if you can track down the names of those two people, I want to thank them on the air in this next half hour here. It's I would appreciate it. Wayne in Fort, I keep forgetting. Wayne in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hey Wayne, what's on your mind today?
Hey, how you doing?
Just great. Funky phone line.
Yeah, thanks for letting me come on. I know it's a bit of change of subject, but I just wanted to plug our product. Is that okay?
Okay.
We've got this Wayne Group Services Air Conditioning Contractors in Fort Lauderdale, Florida.
Uh-huh.
We've got a new IQ Drive, intelligent air conditioning system, 23 SEER rated.
Right. So you just wanted to plug your product? Is that what you're saying?
Well, is that okay or is that rude?
Well, yeah, it's rude. I mean, if there was something, you know, new or extraordinary or innovative
It's a green 410 refrigerant system that's been rated at 23 SEER.
And this is available all over the country?
All over the country, but through a Newtone dealer.
Yeah.
And,
okay.
You know, it's a lot. It's a big stretch from the old 10 SEER, you know. It's safe.
Yeah, no, I get it. Wayne, thanks a lot for the heads up. It's interesting. Earl in Detroit. Hey, Earl, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? I believe I might have a solution to the Michigan delegation seating at the convention in August.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it's going to prolong the process, my idea would. I don't understand why nobody's brought this up, but on August 5th, we're going to be holding a statewide primary to select down-ticket candidates for the November election, and I don't understand why we just can't add Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton to the ballot.
Because it's August 5th. It's too late.
Well, it's still ahead of the convention.
Yeah, but what the Democrats need is June and July. I mean, you would give them August, but basically they need those 2 months to be actively campaigning against John McCain. And once there's no more elections to happen, and now your suggestion would, you know, put Michigan into play again, which I as an old Michigander, I think it's a wonderful thing. I'd love to see Michigan in play. But it's just too close to the primary. They, you know, John McCain is just going to be skating. I mean, he's just going to be skating.
I certainly understand that, but you know, Hillary wants to seat the delegates based on the results of the January 15th election, which wouldn't be right because Barack Obama wasn't even on the ballot, and she argues, well, that was his choice. But the fact of the matter is, I believe it would be wrong to seat the delegation based on those results, and it would be equally wrong to not recognize Michigan.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think that it would be wrong to seat them based on the results of the election if Barack Obama gets the undecided ones. It's not going to change the outcome, frankly. And I know a lot of people voted undecided. And we have to keep in mind, in Michigan, I mean, speaking as somebody who grew up in Michigan and lived in Michigan until I was in my late 20s, Michigan, or mid-20s anyway, Michigan has a long history of primarily Republicans messing in Democratic primaries. And, you know, from getting George Wallace and Jesse Jackson elected as the presidential nominees. I mean, this is all Republican crossover.
Let me just finish this thought, if I may.
In this election, there were a lot of Democrats who said, okay, we're going to play your game. And in that primary, because there were not most of the Democratic candidates on the ballot, including in particular John Edwards, a lot of people, instead of voting uncommitted or instead of voting in the Democratic primary at all, went in and voted in the Republican primary for Mitt Romney for the exact same purpose that Bush has been or that Limbaugh has been doing his Operation Chaos, to cause Romney to burn through more cash. This is something that was suggested by Coase over at the Daily Coase, Marcos. And frankly, all my relatives are in Michigan, my brothers, my family. I know a lot of people, a lot of friends I grew up with. I get back there frequently. I know people. I know a fair number of people, Democrats, who voted for Mitt Romney in the primary because they could. And so I don't think that this vote really means much.
In 2000, I cast a ballot for John McCain. I can't say I voted for John McCain, but in the primary in 2000, I did exactly what you're accusing the Republicans of doing. I cast a ballot for John McCain because John Engler was promising George Bush Michigan, and I detested John Engler, and I detested George Bush. But
exactly. I mean, there's a long history of this in Michigan, and that's why I think that to say, well, the Michigan voters decided that Hillary Clinton should have 56 for whatever, however she won by, you know, whatever the percentage was, that's a real measurement of how the Michigan Democrats feel. A, I don't believe it's a real measurement, but B, you know, if they're given to her anyway, it's not going to change the outcome as long as the other delegates are given to Barack Obama. And that, it seems to be, you know, what the thing is boiling down to, the food fight over Michigan. And,
right.
And I don't know how it's going to be resolved. I'm not going to play prediction games on the show. We're probably going to find out tomorrow or the next day. You know, I think by the end of the day tomorrow we'll know. And
we'll let the chips fall where they may.
Yeah, yeah.
You have a great weekend, Tom.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Earl. Good to hear from you. I appreciate the call. And thanks for listening to us there on WDTW in Detroit. Charles in Carmel Valley, California, listening on KRXA. Hey, Charles.
Hi. I've been listening to these Republicans give these robotic responses about Scott McClellan's book. And they, to me, they sounded like Stepford Wives, you know, the movie Stepford Wives?
Yeah.
I think we should start calling them Stepford Cons.
That's interesting. John Scott, the PD here at or operations manager, whatever his title is here for the San Francisco station, and I were driving out to this event last night, and we were talking about this, and I don't remember which one of us brought the phrase up, but you know, don't they all look the same? Don't they all sound the same? Isn't there almost like a haircut that you can say, oh yeah, that guy's a Republican?
And they're not even embarrassed about it. I got a couple more names here. Let me just run through them real quick, and then how about when they start using the term Democrat Party, it makes my blood boil. I think we should start using the term Republic Corp Party if they don't stop using that word Democrat Party.
Yeah, or Republicans, or the
yeah. I got one more here.
Okay.
Which do you like better, Bill the Shill O'Reilly or Bill Blacklist O'Reilly?
Bill the Shill. but they're good ones. Charles, thanks a lot for the call. Okay. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Oh, amazing. All kinds of great stuff out here. Ken in East Brunswick, New Jersey. It says here on the board you want to disagree with me, so I'll put you at the front of the line. What's up?
Oh, it's actually this disagreement with a particular statement. You and Ellen Ratner were saying sometime last week that you both thought that the imposition of martial law between now and the end of the Bush administration would be unlikely because the American people wouldn't stand for it. A caller a couple of days ago made the analogy of animals backed into a corner. Mm-hmm. I thought that was kind of appropriate. And, you know, with Barack Obama saying that he was committed to, you know, pursuing, evidence of wrongdoing, wherever it leads. And remember, we're not just talking about Bush, but also Cheney. If people are wondering about the dark side of him, they should just Google the testimony of Norman Mineta that was censored out of the 9/11 Commission report. But also, more practically, I'm wondering why would Bush put together this whole continuity of government thing that Peter DeFazio was not allowed to look at? And, let me leave it at that.
Yeah, and Peter has asked numerous times, and it's a good question. I mean, we have had continuity of government things going back to the Eisenhower administration in the event of a nuclear attack in Washington, D.C., and that sort of thing. It's nothing new, but I did not – let me say, Ken, I think it's unlikely that they will impose martial law, and it's unlikely if they did that they would be successful, but I don't think it's impossible. And that's where the, you know, what if we all walked out into the crosswalks, you know, when the walk light was on and then laid down on the street and just started shutting down cities? I mean, it's some sort of a Gandhian protest. I really don't think that they would get away with it over the long term.
I think we may be seeing a preview of what they might have in mind with these so-called national level exercises. You had, I think, Operation Vigilant Shield or something in Oregon, and it was also in Arizona back in October.
We did, in Oregon it was also, I mean, we're living on an earthquake fault, and if the big one hits, We actually want our emergency responders to have some practice. Frankly, I mean, I was there when it happened, and I don't think it was as insidious as all the conspiracy, you know, hoopla around it before it happened. In our local show, we talked with the, as I recall, we talked to the mayor and city councilors.
The broader picture involves rehearsing terrorist attacks and things going on with airplanes. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, there's actually some element of how to control people.
The thing that concerns me along those same lines, but frankly even more, Ken, is the hyper-militarization of our police forces all over the United States. Over the last 10 years, the police forces have been given surplus military equipment, or it's been sold to them at very, very low prices. And so you now have police forces who are essentially paramilitary outfits. That concerns me. 45 minutes past.
The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
Special thanks to Louise Hartman and to Sean Taylor, who produced this show, Sean, our executive producer, to Tony Ryan here in San Francisco, who's helping engineer today, Chris Rosen in New York, Lauren Kirshner in New York, Sean Kensian and Marcus Hillman, who fill in from time to time in New York at Air America, to Sue Nethercutt, the folks in our chat room, and Mike Toth, who does the audio archives over at our website at tomhartman.com, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program. And also to Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, for giving us our daily dose of our reality fix in the fact-based world. What's going on? Hey, Ellen.
Sorry, it's a little noisy. I'm at the United Nations where they're having sort of a bake sale. Actually, it's a Chinese writing sale and everything that they can possibly cook up to raise some money for the Chinese earthquake victims here.
That's great. Hey, Ellen, quick question with regard to the UN. Joe Madison was on the show yesterday. Of course, you and Joe and I were in southern Sudan on the border with Darfur just a couple of months ago. And an entire city, 100,000 people, the government of North Sudan, of Bashir, came in and murdered 100,000 people last week. Is the UN, is there an outrage? I mean, what's going on?
Well, there is an outrage, and in fact, the Secretary General will be going there next week, and the entire Security Council is going there for about 10 days.
To Sudan?
Well, they're going to Sudan for about 2 days, and I think they're also going to Darfur, and they're going to Africa basically for 10 days.
Wow. Well, I think that's sort of
a first in a long time. I mean, you don't see the entire Security Council going somewhere.
Yeah, if they're now, going to,
week,
if they see
be
what
we saw. Broadcasting from here on Thursday.
Pardon?
You're broadcasting from here on Thursday.
Yes, I'll be doing my show from the United Nations with your radio
right.
row there on Thursday.
So you're going to get a chance to talk to everybody yourself.
Oh, great, great. Thank you.
Well, let's just talk a little bit about what's going on tomorrow with the Democratic National Committee. Their lawyers have prepared all kinds of scenarios for them. Today, the Hillary Clinton people had a press conference call in which they said that there were 2.3 million voters excluded, that they believe the full delegate should be counted, and that she believes that neither candidate can win without the superdelegates. They want to show that they are the only group, or the Hillary Clinton campaign is the only group who can win the 270 electoral votes needed, and that Florida and Michigan are going to be needed, and that she has the capacity to win those states, and Obama does not. And that is basically their argument.
That's interesting. Today's San Francisco Chronicle, I'm broadcasting live from San Francisco today. The front page story, top of the fold, Clinton losing ground in state poll says, and they point out that even though Hillary Clinton won this state in a landslide, 51-38, She is now behind. Where's the numbers? I'd have to dig into it. But she's behind Barack Obama now, statewide in the polls. It's pretty amazing.
It is pretty amazing. Also, as you know, I like to sometime on Friday give an outrage of the week.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently yesterday, the Icelandic parliament made a resolution condemning United States abuses in Guantanamo.
Mm-hmm.
Condoleezza Rice said today that she strongly objects to the notion that there are human rights violations in Guantanamo. I mean, what? I don't know. I must be on a planet Lib, and she must be on planet Republican, and the planets are not even in the same universe.
Well, there's two problems here. One may be, you know, her simple denial and just not understanding it or getting it. I suspect that's less likely. I think what's more likely is that if she acknowledges that there's human rights violations in Guantanamo, then she's acknowledging criminal complicity in a conspiracy to violate federal law and international law.
Well, yes, and breaking our treaties.
Right. Yeah. And I don't think that she can do that. I mean, she's in a situation where if she does that, if she says, if she speaks the truth, she goes to jail, or she could, at least could be subject to impeachment and or worse. And so I'm not surprised that she's saying that, frankly.
Well, the other outrage of the week is that President Bush called President Musharraf today. I guess he's not president anymore. Or maybe he's president, but anyhow, he called Musharraf to have strong support. I guess he's president, but not prime minister.
Right.
Strong support for Pakistan and for his continued role.
We like dictators.
Love dictators.
Yeah, the Bush administration, you know, you overthrow a government by military force. Yeah, we're right there with you. And, you know, hopefully that's not a glimpse into the soul of George W. Bush, but. Anyway.
Now, if you look at a lot of local papers around, the Republicans have gone out with local op-eds from almost every member of Congress that they can, Republican member of Congress, with their plan, which is to including oil drilling in the Anwar and $20 billion in alternative, in money for alternative loans, et cetera, and tax breaks for companies to do alternative energy. But, so this is their, what I call their local op-ed offense. The First Lady was also in New Orleans talking about faith-based resources. They said that they got $2.5 billion for New Orleans and the Gulf, and she praised local leaders, charter schools, and faith-based schools as part of the recovery.
Yeah, they're trying to reinvent America as something where everybody in times of disaster is dependent upon the power of Rod Parsley mega churches or, Bill Gates wealth or Warren Buffett wealth.
Well, I have which we can discuss at another time, but after I left you, I went to an evangelical church last week in Orange County, California. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, well, let's talk about it next week. I look forward to it. Thanks so much. Ellen. Great having you on. By the way, Laura Spangen was the was the Hillary Clinton delegate last night. And Jeff, the Obama one, I don't have his last name, but I wanted to thank both of them for showing up. Next week, Pat Buchanan is going to drop by and Kerry Lucas. We'll have some interesting conversations there. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. Have a great weekend. We'll see you Monday.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.